following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
We were speaking last time on the prohibition of all sorts of immorality. Now, the Torah goes and elaborates. So I'm just going to go through them just to give you an example. And the truth of the matter is that when you wonder to yourself, you know, come on, who are they talking to? All you have to do is pick up any newspaper or magazine, right? And you see that everything that the Torah is discussing when it comes to all sorts of, particularly incestuous relationships and all sorts of combinations of immorality, all you got to do is pick up any periodical nowadays, right? And you'll see that the Torah is talking to our generation. Because you see all forms of perversion still take place nowadays, right? All forms of incestuous relationships still take place. So 189 is to not commit homosexuality with one's father, right? One, if you want it afterwards, I'll go through specifically. Number 190 is not to be involved in sexual relations with one's mother. 191 is not to have a relationship with the father's wife, right? The father's wife, one's stepmother. Okay. 192 is to not have sexual relations with one's sister. Now this involves, this includes a half-sister, right? It includes a half-sister or any type of sister, a half-sister either from the mother's side or from the father's side. What is strange is that according to halacha, it would be permissible to marry your stepsister. A person could marry their stepsister according to halacha, where you are not related to her blood relative in any way, shape, or form. You would not be allowed, you would even be allowed to marry an adopted sister, right? Two siblings, where one or both of them have been adopted, and they are not blood relatives of each other, the halacha is that they would be allowed to, marry each other. The Chafetz Chaim, when the Chafetz Chaim got married, he was 16 years old. The Chafetz Chaim's mother was a widow, and she remarried a man who had a daughter. And when they wanted, the Chafetz Chaim was hot stuff. Right, a couple times could have gotten a very good shidduch, and there was some argument as to who he was going to marry. And in order that the mother and stepfather shouldn't quarrel with each other, the Chafetz Chaim married his stepsister. The Chafetz Chaim married her simply as a means of maintaining harmony in the home. Right, that's why he was the Chafetz Chaim, and she was already not so young. She was 18. Right. So, Chafetz Chaim was willing to marry. He could have gotten, in those days, the girls were getting married 13, 14 years old. They even say that in the times of the Chafetz Chaim, there was a guy who was 13 years old, and the word spread that he knew he was fluent in the entire Shas. Right? He was 13 years old, he was fluent in the entire Shas, and the Shadchans, the matchmakers, were all converging on his home, trying to get the suitable match. The way it used to work is the bigger the scholar, wealthy businessmen would very often go for a scholar as a son-in-law, and then they would support him so he could study, and eventually he would be able to start. We were speaking about living in one's parents' home. They would take the married couple, and they would live with their parents for usually about 5 years, so the husband could study unencumbered, and then he would develop into a halachic authority. He would become a rabbi of a town. That's how they develop. Very often, money speaks, right? And what determines the shit out very often, and why should you marry if all else is equal, you're going to try to marry somebody where you have support. This guy was 13 years old, and the matchmakers were coming in hot and heavy, right? Everybody wanted this guy, 13 years old, fluent in the entire Shas, the future's unbelievably rosy. Then they found out that there was a scam. He was not 13 years old, he was 15 years old, and fluent in the entire Shas, and everybody backed off. Because in those days, 15 years old and fluent in Shas is no trick, right? 13 with Shas, that's already something. That's already something remarkable. 15, no big deal, right? So they let him go. So that's what it says. You're allowed to marry a stepsister. You're not allowed to, very quickly, I'll give you the numbers later. You don't have to write down each one. Do not have a relationship with your son's daughter. Not have a relationship with your daughter's daughter. Do not have a relationship with your own daughter. Right, and remember, all these things are in every day, every paper, that you pick up, you'll find stuff like this nowadays. To not have relations with the father's daughter from another wife. And the next one is the father's sister. And then there's the mother's sister, and there's the father's brother. Right? To have a homosexual relationship with the father's brother. Now what's absolutely incredible about this, what's amazing here, is that on Yom Kippur, when we read the Torah at Mincha, on Yom Kippur, this is all from the Torah portion of Acharimos in the book of Vayikra. In the on Yom Kippur, at Mincha on Yom Kippur, when we read a portion of the Torah, the portion of the Torah that we read, this is an hour or two before the judgment is sealed on Yom Kippur, when we read a Torah portion, this is the portion of the Torah that we read. We read all about the prohibited relationships. Why? On Yom Kippur, at the height of the day, the most intense moment, we're heading towards Ne'ilah, the day is ending, and we read about the prohibited relationships. Why? What do you think?
Because those are things you definitely didn't do. It's easy. In other words, like,
you're an optimist. Commentaries say it's because rooted deeply in man's heart is the subject of immorality. Sexual immorality is rooted so deeply, even on Yom Kippur, even on the Day of Judgment, these are the things that a person is still focused on, and therefore the Torah wants to, we re-emphasize once again those prohibited relationships. Yeah.
Is it true that those things that happen, Hashem gives them a really strong temptation for people to have?
No more than nowadays. Nowadays there are all sorts of arguments that it's okay. In the old days, everybody agreed that it wasn't okay. Nowadays, you have the rationalization. No.
Question?
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't really tracked them down, but everybody's married in the family somewhere.
The entire existence of man is based on incestuous relationships. Cain married his... Adam married... who did Adam marry? Right, he married himself, right? If you want to get right down to it, he was split up. He was born as androgynous being. He was split, and then, so to speak, he married his mate, which had actually come from part of him. Cain married his sister. Hevel married his sister, right? All the tribes that they were born with sisters to marry. Eventually, after the world was populated, then it became prohibited to be involved in any of the incestuous relationships. Okay. Number 200, we're up to 200. Again, there's a whole list of the daughter-in-law and the brother's wife. Now, here is the one exception, and this is one of those anomalies in the Torah. It is severely prohibited to marry your brother's wife. You know that. That means if a man's brother is married to somebody, it is prohibited, absolutely prohibited, to be involved in a relationship with his sister-in-law. And even if his brother dies, his sister-in-law is still completely off-limits. Except if his brother dies childless. If his brother and sister-in-law die childless, then not only is it permissible for him to marry his sister-in-law, at that point it becomes a mitzvah for him to marry his sister-in-law.
Not a requirement.
It's a mitzvah, not a requirement, it's a mitzvah because there is an option. The option is what's called the chalitza ceremony. The chalitza ceremony, that means that when his brother dies and the brother is childless, the sister-in-law is automatically bonded to him. That means she is not allowed to marry somebody else. She's now a widow, correct? She is a widow, but she is not allowed to marry anybody else. She's not allowed to marry anybody else unless something is done to release her from this bond. Now, he has one of two choices. He could either live with her, and by doing that, he marries her. He lives with her, and by living with her, he actually marries her, and that completes the relationship. Or he has to turn her loose. That means let her marry anyone else other than himself. That is called the chalitza ceremony. The chalitza ceremony is where his shoe is removed, and she spits on the floor in front of his shoe. The very deep symbolism in it, what it's symbolizing, the fact that he doesn't want to perpetuate his brother's name. She spits on the floor in front of him. They go through this ceremony, and this is done in Beis Din. And once it's done in Beis Din, then she's free to marry anybody else. Now, one of these common problems in our day and age was where a woman, who let's say you have a couple living in Russia. This is very common. Couples living in Russia, and a husband dies, right? Or the other way around. You got a couple living in America. The husband dies childless, And the brother is living in Russia, and the Iron Curtain was still not down yet, so he can't get out of Russia. His sister-in-law, living in the United States, is now prohibited from marrying anybody else until he either comes along and marries her, or he performs the chalitza ceremony. Nowadays, the marriage ceremony is not performed, by the way. Nowadays, we do not, the brother-in-law does not marry his sister-in-law. Nowadays, because the sages at a certain time point felt that the ceremony cannot be done with the proper mitzvah motivation, right, that he may have other incentives. Therefore, it's not done, but the chalitza is absolutely a requirement, and if the chalitza is not done, then they're prohibited. And the...
Is the second option a... Is it an option, the brother becoming father of a child in this relationship, or is it not allowed? So just say if the husband dies and the wife doesn't catch up the birth name, what happens?
If she and the brother-in-law would agree to marry each other, if she and the brother...
He's married already.
Oh, if he's married already, the brother is married already. Okay, so since there's a rabbinic decree against marrying two wives, he's got no option, and he must release her. He must release her with the chalitza ceremony.
And it can't be done out of wedlock. It can't be done.
No. It's got to be done. It's got to be done with proper sanction. I mean, he got to have an option. He could divorce his wife and then marry her, right? Theoretically, that would be an option. It wouldn't be done, right? But theoretically, that would be an option. Yeah.
If there's three brothers, is the oldest?
Good question. It goes to the oldest. The oldest brother has to either pass or play, right? Now,
he
could pass it on to the next brother, and he could pass it on to the next brother, right? He says, I don't want to marry her, but I don't want to ruin it for everybody else, right? And he could give it an option to the next brother. He could do the same thing. If they've gone through all the brothers, and at that point, the youngest brother says, I don't want to have anything to do, then the Beis Din says to the oldest one, then it comes back to the oldest one, and the court says to the oldest one, okay, it's to you. You've got to make the decision, either marry her or release her. Right. If the brother, now, you have a situation, according to, let's go back to Torah times, where such a thing was an act. Right? You should know, by the way, this is something that was found in all societies. All societies had some form of perpetuating the name of the deceased. Someone in the next of kin would marry the wife who was left childless. Right? I think in certain societies they do that today, where a woman who's widowed and has no children, somebody in the family marries her in order to perpetuate the name. If, let's say you have a situation where the oldest brother is married to his wife. Now, the oldest brother is 25 and his wife is 24, and the oldest brother dies. Now, there's a 24-year-old woman who's childless. And he's got, and his next brother is, let's say, 9 years old, right? Or his next brother is 5 years old. You have that situation, right? So there the court will tell the brother to do the chalitza ceremony, right? Because, or if, let's say he's over the age of bar mitzvah, so then let's say she's 35 and he's 14, right? Well, they're not that well suited. So the court would tell them that he should release her. They would give him the advice to release her and not go through the yibum ceremony.
Does the woman have to marry the brother?
If she absolutely despises him, she could, you know, if she really doesn't want to, not. But generally, the assumption is that people emotionally would want to perpetuate the name of the deceased. And that's the idea. The idea is some way of perpetuating his name. Okay, now.
So would the children of the brother who married that widow be then named after...
That's the way the Torah words it. That's the way the Torah words it. What the Torah means by that, there are different opinions of the Torah means. But generally, yes, he carries the name of the deceased brother.
No, he's not really a son.
Well, it's regarded as the neshama of the deceased has come back now in the face. That's why you get all this stuff. There's a very big fuss made with naming, by the way. When a baby is born, you could avoid, it's a tremendous, tremendous fight when a baby is born. And Kabbalistically, it says that a baby that's born and there's fighting over the name, the baby's life is in danger. This is Kabbalistically. So what people do is they name. Now what happens is people say one Zeta's name is Chaim and the other Zeta's name is Yitzchak, so they name the baby Chaim Yitzchak, right? And everybody's a happy compromise for everybody. But then they could fight about, well, why did you name him Chaim before Yitzchak? Why did you name Yitzchak Chaim? But they'll find something to fight about. The bottom line is that if you're really trying to do it right, you have not done anything. All you've done is you've created a new name called Chaim Yitzchak. Right. You have not got Chaim named after, and you've got Yitzchak, anybody named after him. I heard one story about a man who, before he died, his last will was to his children, do not name me after anybody if there's anybody ahead of me in line to be named. Right? Because he didn't want any fighting. Right? He wanted his children, if there's any type of conflict, that he should not be named after him. Right? So that it should avoid fighting. Yeah?
So
So what happened if she has to marry someone and somehow they didn't perform the, what is it, chalitza, and she married someone else and they did not do the proper ceremony, you know,
if she married somebody with without chalitza, that rabbinically the children are mamzerim. Wow. Right? And she's prohibited from marrying. It's like she needs a divorce. She's bonded. Yes, that's what I say. If she has not gotten it, then it's a very big problem for her to try and go, for her to go and marry somebody else. A very big problem. Very big problem in halacha. Mamzerim. Bastards. Halacha bastards. Right, that means a child born with all the ramifications. He's not allowed to marry into the Jewish people. He's got all the stigmas of a bastard. Terry, a mamzer is a translation of the word bastard in Hebrew. Now, bastard does not mean a child born out of wedlock. It's not a child. A child born out of wedlock has got no halachic stigmas whatsoever. You should be aware of that. There's no halachic stigmas whatsoever. Not even that. If his father is married and his mother is single, let's say a man cheated on his wife and fathered a child with a single woman, that child has no stigmas in halacha whatsoever. He's a perfectly legitimate child. He's just born out of wedlock. A mamzer is the result of either a married woman who's involved in a relationship or some type of incestuous relationship. I'll tell you in one second. We'll get there in a second. An incredibly tragic story that happened right here in Israel. I think I saw this in the paper within the last year or so in Israel. The next one is the prohibition to marry a woman and her daughter. Right? You marry a woman, you marry your mother. You marry your mother-in-law, so to speak. Right? You marry a woman, you marry your daughter-in-law. Now, when is it prohibited? It's prohibited when you're married to one and then you marry the second one. So you're married to a woman, and then either she's still alive or after she dies, you marry her mother. That's extremely prohibited according to halacha. It's other categories. The next one that I want to get to is there's a granddaughter, a grandson, whatever. The next one is the prohibition to marry two sisters. Now this is a very interesting situation. You're not allowed to marry two sisters. This is number 206. I'll fill in all the others. Don't worry. I'll fill in all the others. This is number 206. Is the prohibition to marry two sisters. Now, what the prohibition is that while one of the sisters is alive, you're not allowed to marry the other one. A man marries a woman. And while he marries this woman, her sister is alive. If she's alive, he's not allowed to marry her sister. If she dies, he is allowed to marry her sister. If he divorces her, he's not allowed to marry her sister unless she dies. Right? So if his divorce, he dies, then he may marry her sister. If his divorce, he's still alive. So that's the rule. You cannot marry two women while they're still alive. There are two tragic cases took place in Israel. Very interesting. Now, what's the idea behind it? The idea behind it is that the Torah does not want that two sisters who are naturally close with each other should then be in a situation where there's going to be a natural enmity between them. What is the enmity? Do you know what a woman is called? A man who's married to a woman and then he has a second wife. Do you know what the word in the Torah is for those two wives? They're called saros. Have you heard the word saros? Saros. Saros, right? Trouble? The Hebrew word for the co-wife is that you're my brother-in-law, right? You're his brother. She is her sorrow. She is her, literally, her trouble, right? But the official word, the mother-in-law, right, this might be better for a mother-in-law, right? But the official word for a co-wife is the tzara. She is the tzara. Now, there was a case here in Israel. A woman got on a bus, right? This was happened about probably 5-6 years ago, I imagine. A woman got on a bus. She got on a bus in Yerushalayim, in one part of the country, and she was going to another part of the country. Got on a bus, a woman was 26 years old, and her three children, somewhere between the ages of an infant and about 3 years old. She got on the bus with her three children, and there was a terrorist attack, and the bus was on fire. She was killed in the fire, and her three children were killed in the fire. A woman and her three children. Now, I think a soldier was also killed. He tried to save her. Instead of trying to get off the bus, apparently she just sat there with the children. She couldn't get out of the plane. She just stayed on the bus with her children. So she was killed on the bus. Now, they never found the body, right? And then what happened was they had a very big question because her family, and this was done in Europe all the time, especially before we had the modern medical techniques, when there was a very high incidence of death during childbirth. So women, very, let's say a woman's giving birth, and Chas Hashem, while she's giving birth, she dies. Now she's left the husband. She's obviously a woman in her childbearing years. So she's left the husband and a bunch of little children in the home. So who is most suitable to now raise those children? Her sister. Her sister is going to be the most suitable person. And very often that's what was done. A man would marry his wife's sister. If the wife died prematurely, he would marry her sister. It's the next natural, the natural choice, especially if there are children involved. Now, what happened? This woman was killed on the bus, and she and her three children were killed. The family, a while later, the family decided they had another sister, and the family proposed that her sister should marry her husband. Her husband was left alone. Her sister was single, and her husband is now single. And it's perfectly okay according to halacha because the first wife has died, right? So they proposed that the sister should marry her husband. What was the problem? The problem was they never found the body, right? So you have no evidence of the death of the woman, right? And therefore, if she maybe she was never on the bus. She told the husband she's going to be on the bus, and no one before she no one ever saw her get on. No one saw her get off. All we know is she said she was going to be on the bus, and she apparently the bus was attacked. She died. No one could account for her. So it seems like she was killed in the attack, but you have no way of knowing for sure. At that point, you have it in reverse all the time, where a woman can't remarry because her husband has disappeared. That's called naguna. A woman can't marry. Her husband, he says, I'm going off on a trip. They had a tragic case like this in Israel in 1967. There was a submarine called the Dakar. Right? And the Dakar lost contact. Where are they coming from? They were coming from England, weren't they? I think they're coming from England. They lost contact with the submarine. I think there were 57 men on board. They never saw or heard from them again. All of their wives cannot remarry because we don't know what has happened to the husbands. It's an aguna. Here you had a unique case where it's the reverse, where the man cannot marry a specific woman. A woman can't marry anybody because her husband. Here the man can't marry a specific woman because his first wife might be alive. So they went to Rabbi Eliyashiv. Rabbi Eliyashiv lives right here in Yerushalayim. And Rabbi Eliyashiv said that they had the dental charts, right? And they, based on the dental charts, that's how they originally determined that she was dead. They did find teeth. Right, so they based on the dental charts, they determined that she had died. Right, and they had to ask if those dental charts are good enough to allow the husband to marry her sister. Rabbi Yosher said yes. Right, based on the evidence, Rabbi Yosher said yes. Right, so that was case number one. The other case was an incredible tragedy. Yet a man was married to a woman, and this man and woman had 10 children. Now, her mother came forward. What happened, the way the story broke, I don't remember, I think one of the brothers, one of the kids went to the authorities. If a man is married to a woman, they have 10 children, somebody came forward and said that this man had been married to his wife's sister for a couple of months and then divorced her. Right? Now, if that would be true, that he was married to her sister, and then he divorced her, and then he marries the second woman, has 10 children from her, every one of those 10 children is a mamzer. Right? The ramifications of this are that he would have to divorce his wife, and any of his children that are married have to divorce their siblings, because a mamzer is not allowed to marry a Jewish person, and that would are the ramifications. So here are the cases. You've got the man married to the woman and their 10 children, and they're hanging in the balance. There's now a rumor that this man was married to his wife's sister for a short period of time. His wife's mother, in other words, the grandmother in the case, came forward and she said, yes, he was married to my other daughter, but my other daughter was adopted. Right? Which takes care of everything. Right? Because if he was married to her and he divorced her, there was no relationship between them whatsoever. 6 months later, she came to the chief rabbinate in one of the cities here, and she said, what I testified earlier was under duress. My son-in-law threatened he'd kill me if I came forward. They were both natural daughters. They are both natural daughters. What had happened was that he was from Iraq or Iran, I don't remember where it was. He was married to the first sister for about 3 months when he was in his teens. They got divorced after 3 months. He came to Israel. 13 years later, he married her older sister, and then they get together, had 10 children. Every one of them was ruled halachically a mamzer. they had to divorce their spouses, he had to divorce his wife, and you've got a massive tragedy.
But I understand what the kids are members. You see, the kids are members, one from an adulterous relationship, one from an incestuous.
An incestuous or prohibited relationship. Certain prohibited relationships. You see, you have certain situations where a man can't marry his wife's sister. Right? They're the children. Let's say a Kohen marries a divorcee. Now, if a Kohen marries a divorcee, that's also a prohibited relationship, but the children are not mamzerah. They have a different stigma, but they're not mamzerah. But here you have a situation where every one of the central children is mamzerah. Terrible tragedy. I remember I saw a picture in the paper. They had blacked out the faces. But they had a picture among these 10 children. Some of them were frum, some of them were not frum, right? Some were, but every one of them was now considered halachically a mamzerah. And so that's what those are the situations you could run into when it comes to the yichus, the qualifications of who can marry you.
That still happens. Of course.
So there are different quests, there are different opinions among the halachic authorities about how far back do you have to trace, right? Do you have to trace? Do you know the Talmud says that when a man got married, he would have to trace back his wife's, I mean, it worked on both sides, but he have to trace back her lineage several generations, they have to check his lineage several generations to find out who's suitable to marry who. Maybe there's something hidden along the way. It's interesting, Gemara says somebody who was a communal charity collector, that you don't have to check his lineage. Someone who was involved in communal, there are various people, a Kohen who served in a temple, you don't have to try and check his lineage, and somebody who was a communal charity collector, you don't have to check his lineage. Why? Because somebody, a Kohen who served in the temple, obviously there was a lineage check done on him before he ever got into the temple. What about a communal charity collector? So the Gemara says, a communal charity collector, there are so many people upset with him for constantly asking for charity. Right? This is the guy who comes around house to house, door to door, asking for charity. So many people are upset with him, they've probably called him every name in the book, right? Including all sorts of stories about his lineage. So if he was a communal charity collector and we haven't heard anything negative about him up until this point, you can be sure there's no dirt. Because if there was, somebody would have dug it up and would have exposed it already. That's a Gemara. It's not a joke. That's what the Gemara says. Such a person is not, he's beyond reproach, and you don't have to do any checking over there. Number 208. Okay, 207, we already discussed the idea of not being involved with a woman who is a Nida. And now we're completely off the subject. We're on to a completely different subject. This is the prohibition, a specific prohibition besides idol worship, which is prohibited in the Torah, a fascinating mitzvah. This is the prohibition for a man to hand, not just a man, a woman also, but it just says, it is prohibited to give over your children to the idol worship called Molech. There's a certain idol worship, a form of idol worship, and it was called Molech. Now, the concept is as follows. There are different opinions. There's a basic fundamental machlokas. How was this idol worship? According to some, there were two large pillars of fire, and there were these priests that were the priests for this Molech idol, and they would take the child, give the child to the priest. The priest would walk with the child between the two pillars of fire, and then he would give the child back to the parents. That was the whole thing, right? Whatever else it involved, right? That was the Molech. That's according to some. According to others, it was not like that. According to others, Molech was actually where they took the child and they burnt the child to death. Now, the Medrash says, I hate to draw on this as an example. How many of you have seen the Ten Commandments on TV? Right. Okay, so you're all tainted just like I am, right? There's one scene over there where Pharaoh's son dies, right? In the movie, Pharaoh's son dies, and the Pharaoh, out of desperation, there's some idol with the hands stretched out, and they put the son on this idol. According to the commentaries, the way Molech worked is, there was an idol deep inside the room. It was a hollow metal type of idol with a fire inside. They would take the child, and they would put the child, but this thing is red hot, they would put the child on the idol itself, and in order to stop, to drown out the screams of the child, the idol-worshipping priest would beat the drums over at the entrance to drown out the screams so the father shouldn't change his mind. What was the idea of such a thing? And the truth is that this explains kind of human sacrifice in general, right? What was the idea of human sacrifice? What was the idea? Why would anybody be so stupid is to actually have one of their children give up, kill a child, right, or commit idol worship. Somebody just told me recently, who was it, the Aztecs? When who was it who got to the Aztecs first? What was the name of the Spanish guy? Was Magellan?
No, Cortez.
So Cortez, when he got there, apparently they saw him riding on the horse. Rabbi Rubin told me this. They saw him riding in on the horse. There were no horses in the American continent at that point, north or south. And they saw him riding in. They landed the ship with horses. They saw him riding on the horse. They thought he was some type of deity. They thought that the man on the horse was all one deity. So apparently the Aztecs came up to him to worship him. They had their prisoners with them, and they immediately cut out one of the prisoners' hearts to serve it to him. Right? And apparently you're supposed to eat the heart after it was cut out for you. And apparently the Spanish who were watching it just lost it right on the spot. Right? They you know, but they were steeped in human. What's the idea? What's the idea of human sacrifice? So the commentaries explain the belief in the pagan world was that if you'd be willing to undertake or undergo one tragedy, one misfortune, then the gods would have mercy on you and not bring any more misfortune on you. Right? So the promise from the priests to the people was, you sacrifice your child, and the gods will be so pleased with you that never again will there be any more children of yours that the gods have to take. Right? The Torah specifically enumerates this as